Welcome to Recalculating Small Business. Like its award-winning book, Recalculating is dedicated to small business in America. Your hosts are Don Mazzella and Dan Perkins. Don Mazzella is the editor-in-chief of the Small Business Digest. Dan Perkins is a registered investment advisor with 43 years' experience in managing money.
Dan Perkins here, your co-host, along with Don Mazzella of Recalculating for Small Business. Our radio program is dedicated to you, helping the small business owners increase their profits. We draw our name from Recalculating, voted the best small business book of 2017 by the Independent Press. In this book, it features ways to grow your small business. Now, here's Don Mazzella.
Dan, you're going to love our next guest. Jade Lambert is here to talk about the Me Too world today. I'm not going to say anything else because I'm going to ask Jade to explain what she means. Jade, welcome to the program. First, I'm going to ask you a little bit about your background and then a little bit about what we talked about earlier. So welcome to the program.
Well, thank you very much. It's good to be here. My name is Jade Lambert. I'm a partner at the law firm of King & Spalding in the Chicago office, and I have been doing high-stakes, sensitive litigation and internal investigations for about 11 years now, including cases where there were allegations of sexual harassment or assault.
I told you, Dan, this is going to be interesting.
Okay.
Jade, you have some very good ideas, and please, the floor is yours. Explain why you're here and what you found over these 11 years.
Sure. Well, I'm here to talk about, especially for business owners and entrepreneurs, about things that they can do to create a good workplace culture and reduce legal and compliance risks. And I think that the current moment that we're in with Me Too, which isn't a new concept. I mean, Tarana Burke started it in the MySpace era, but this past October, it really took off in the wake of the Harvey Weinstein investigation and the New York Times story. So a lot of companies of all sizes are concerned about workplace culture and what they can be doing to build out a culture of compliance and to deal with potential allegations of workplace harassment and assault. So, we help clients both on the front end to do planning and counseling, and also if an issue arises to do investigation either for an independent view or if they're looking for somebody to investigate for purposes of defending against litigation.
Well, Jade, I'm going to ask one question and then turn it over to Dan. Being two males who have been involved in business for many years, some of the things, and being older people, some of the things that we took for granted when we started in most of our career now seem to be under attack. Just to give you one example for me, I like to mentor young people, and whether they're male or female makes no difference. But I've noticed over the last couple of years that this has become an extremely difficult issue for a lot of men and even women, as the younger people seem to be extremely sensitive to any sort of intimacy beyond anything. Would you like to comment on that?
Sure. I mean, I think there are, some potentially different views and sensitivities based on generation. But as somebody, I've worked in a lot of industries, not just the law firm industry. I've worked on factory floors. I've spent a lot of years as a server. But I think what's universal in terms of the workplace and mentorship is that it's not that the rules of the road aren't that difficult and they could be easily learned if somebody's facing challenges. And I think that there's a risk that if men look at it as some sort of a risk of just interacting with women in the workplace, then that's not the result that anybody wants, because then women lose out on these great mentorship and development opportunities you talked about. So I think it's really just a matter of facilitating a respectful and sensitive culture, and that may mean that some of the things that were okay, you know, 20, even 10 years ago are no longer okay, but it's mostly just about being respectful, setting the right tone at the top. You know, not touching people is one that people have different levels of comfort with. So the safest bet is to not touch your coworkers, not comment on their physical appearance, but also at the same time, you want to make your coworkers, both men and women, feel like they're valuable and part of the team. And I think the hardest one in a workplace setting, because nobody wants to be the killjoy, is that if something really is inappropriate, to speak up and say something, because I think one of the biggest barriers to creating a good workplace environment for women is when the people who don't approve of the conduct say nothing, that allows bad conduct to proliferate.
I have a lot of questions, but I'm going to turn it over to Dan first.
Great.
Thank you. Welcome to the show.
Thanks, Dan.
Let me give you a couple of things that I have read about. The Me Too movement, when it first came out this year or last year, was driven by Harvey Weinstein and his behavior. And then as that realization spread, we found that it was not just Hollywood. We found that public broadcasting had a problem, and some of the networks had a problem, besides the heads of studios. And in non-entertainment businesses were having a problem, and the government was having a problem. And so if I can equate that, the reaction to those problems, as a pendulum, one of the things that concerns me is that the pendulum has swung perhaps too far, and in a direction. I won't say left or right, because that's not necessarily appropriate, but it swung to the point where there are, as Don talks about, there are people who have the ability to be wonderful mentors who are, and this is not a sensational word, who are paranoid that something that they do will be misconstrued, and they find themselves on the evening news because this particular person has decided that whatever that person did was sexual harassment. So I'm saying that I think that one of the pendulum swing problems is that the women are actually going to suffer in terms of opportunities because of Don said, and I believe it's true, there are people who are reluctant now to engage with women because of the fear of that if it doesn't go well, they don't like what they're hearing from the boss is going to be, complaints are going to be filed against the boss. And in reality, while we are a nation of laws that says one is innocent until proven guilty, in these particular situations, I suspect that people are guilty until they can prove they're innocent.
Dan, that's a lot to unpack, but let me offer a few thoughts. One is that, I mean, I think you're right that we are talking about a pendulum. And, you know, historically, you could say that the pendulum was too far in the other direction, where a lot of bad behavior was being excused, ignored, facilitated, swept under the rug. So is there a risk of overcorrection? I imagine, sure, there's always a risk of something like that. But at the same time, you know, the word you used was paranoid. And I think that paranoia connotes a fear that's not really particularly well-founded. And I think that is the case here, because I think there, you know, I'd like to say that the majority of men that I've encountered both in my professional life and in my life in the service industry and everything else have been good, upstanding guys who understand, who know how to be appropriate. It's not that difficult, and I don't think it's a matter of having to never be alone with a woman. So I don't think that particular fear is a rational one. I mean, sure, is it a possibility that in some small percentage of cases that could happen? Yes. But I think that that it's not a good reason to not mentor women, because, you know, the flip side of that is that you're losing out on really valuable employees and probably some of your best people. You're missing out on that chance. And I think the risk of missing out on these great employees and giving them a chance to develop and add value to the organization is actually a more significant risk than the one that an employee with an axe to grind is going to falsely accuse you of something inappropriate.
But I understand your point of view, and I appreciate it. But from a practical standpoint, the thing that concerns me is that, the as I said, guilty until proven innocent. I have seen and read reports of what happens to corporations when an executive in that corporation is accused, and how it literally taints the entire corporation, and that people lose their focus, they lose what they're trying to do in the business, they become very concerned about what's happening to the boss, and if something's happening to the boss, what's going to happen to the company, and what's going to happen to my prospects? So I think that it is a serious problem. And I think that women are paying a higher price. We had another attorney of in the same field that you were in, and I mentioned, I'm not going to say what company it was, but in that particular interview I did, I mentioned that this particular president said that he was making a corporate policy that senior executives of the firm could no longer meet with female employees alone in their offices. And this attorney said that he should have been fired. And I challenged that because he's dealing with what he perceives to be the reality of risk to his company, and is unwilling to take that risk. And so that he established a policy that it just wasn't going to happen. He's still there. He took some criticism, but it went away very quickly. And still does not meet, as far as I can tell, does not meet with any woman employee on his own. There's either another woman or somebody else in the room with him. And so I do believe that there is potential, but I'm also moving away from the executives and deal with the rank and file employees. I suspect that the pendulum of we've talked about earlier has swung even down to the rank and file, that there are perhaps male employees who are reluctant to disengage or engage and wind up disengaging with female employees because they don't know what the ramifications might be if they disagree with that particular person. So what I'm saying is, in a different way, is that the level of risk taking, not in a negative sense, but companies need people to take certain degree of risk in order for the companies to grow and prosper. I am very concerned that risk-taking is diminished in many American corporations.
Yeah, I think that for that to be the approach, I think that's an overstatement of the real risk of that. And unfortunately, it sort of ascribes these bad motives to women as a whole, that they're going to if they don't get their way, that they're going to seek revenge or something like that. And I think that's, I mean, that's a very negative approach versus something that's more proactive about just setting a tone and an expectation that employees of all sexes will be treated with civility and respect. And I think that, you know, you're talking a lot about, you're talking about risk, but you're also talking about a reactive setting. And there's no doubt that the stakes are high right now when these kind of allegations are lodged against corporate leadership. I mean, we've seen how quickly this stuff unfolds in the media. We've seen how swift the action and response has been from corporate America on some of these things. But I think that's why it's all the more important for organizations to be proactive and try to facilitate a good culture where, you know, employees across the board treat each other with respect. Because, you know, women have been talking about this stuff for a long time, and you know, by and large in any organization, the women kind of know who the creeps are, and probably a lot of the men know too. There can be open secrets about people's bad behavior or who gets drunk and inappropriate at the office Christmas party, right?
So
again, I think I would just say I think most people behave appropriately, and people who are asking, is it okay for me to be alone with a woman, or is it too risky for me to be alone? I don't think that's the right question to be asking. I think they should be asking, how can I behave appropriately so that I minimize the risk of anything ever being said about me?
I'd like to jump in here and say, ask Jade, what are the things that small, before we get too far into this, what are the three or four things you think a small business should do to be proactive?
Sure. I mean, you know, one of the things is to have a policy, an anti-harassment policy that has simple descriptions of prohibited conduct, that assures that there will be prompt action and corrective action as needed if allegations are substantiated. I think you want a clear reporting structures for your employees in terms of, depending on the size of the organization, if it's a large organization, you can do something like an ethics hotline, great, but for smaller businesses, to have at least more than one person you can report to, and if possible, an option for anonymous reporting. And then a no retaliation policy is really important to, you know, make employees feel safe to report bad conduct. And the other thing is just the leadership has to set the right example. And, you know, that can include everything from mentoring women to treating all of your colleagues with respect and saying that this is, you know, that behavior that is harassing or non-inclusive isn't tolerated. So it's really about setting the right tone within the organization.
Back to you, Dan. I just wanted to get that out because that's why Jade is here.
Sure, that's fine. I'm curious your reaction to, I'm going to throw out a number, and I don't know whether it's a right number or a wrong number, but it's at least a number to start with. If I look at the number of incidents that have been claimed and reported in the mass media of individuals, both men and women, who have been involved in sexual harassment or other facets, I'm going to guess it's probably less than 100 people. The question then becomes, are we, by your own admission that, and I use the word majority, but a lot of people understand what the rules of the road are, has the media and the Me Too movement blown the magnitude of the problem out of proportion?
I don't think they have, and this is why, Dan. I think that the magnitude of the problem is about a large part about both socially and in the workforce, the types of behaviors that have been shrugged off and tolerated historically, and especially in workplace environments where, you know, there are unequal allocations of power. So some of the stories that have gotten the biggest traction have been about powerful men who are arguably abusing their authority to, you know, facilitate sexual misconduct, and that it's a long track record that somebody within the organization knew about because there's, you know, multiple settlements, NDAs, et cetera. So I think that it's not getting blown out of proportion in the sense that a lot of bad behaviors have been excused and overlooked or not treated with a level of seriousness historically. And there's a need to reexamine some of the approaches that we've been using historically. That said, is it a problem that, you know, I don't think that it's a problem that a majority of senior executives are behaving badly. I think the problem is that a lot of organizations might have a couple of bad apples, and I think the problem or the challenge for organizations is to not let the bad behavior of a couple of individuals that may even be open secrets sort of taint the culture and make it a less welcoming environment for women.
There was a Republican congressman from Texas who resigned last week because he used his congressional expense account to pay $82,000 to a woman who claimed sexual harassment using taxpayers' dollars. And that was a big problem 6 months ago when a number of congressmen were found to have used their personal budgets to settle harassment claims. The Don asked you the question, what are the things that you would recommend that corporations do? Should corporations have a separate person if they're above a certain number of people? Should there be a staff position to deal with this, or is that overkill?
I mean, if you're talking about a dedicated staff person to deal only with claims of sexual harassment and potential settlements, I don't think that's necessary for every organization. I think that, you know, a challenge of any organization as it scales is building legal compliance into the organization. So I think that it's really just a matter of building in that compliance function, not just sexual harassment, but all aspects of compliance, and that you know, as you grow large enough to have an HR function and potentially a legal function, that it makes sense to have someone to deal with that. I mean, you should have one or more persons identified within an organization to make sure that any complaints about these issues get appropriately escalated and disseminated. And that's just a matter of a policy of letting people know to whom they can report. And then once the report reaches it, making sure whoever is the appropriate person within the organization. And depending on what the specific complaint is, there may be a need to involve, if it's a small enough company that they don't have their own sort of in-house lawyer, that they might want to involve somebody, some kind of outside lawyer to evaluate the claim and potentially help investigate it. And even if they do have in-house counsel, when allegations involve C-level type of people, you may want to get an independent view just because of the possibility of a conflict of interest. Do we need to change the federal law? I think the federal law, I think Title VII is a good tool and a good starting point for dealing with workplace harassment and hostile work environment. I haven't, thought through a lot of how I would change it. I don't think any law is perfect, but I think it's been a good vehicle. But to me, this is more of a culture issue than it is a law issue in a lot of ways. And certainly depending on the culture, can certainly bring legal risks with it. But as I sit here, I don't think of it as a failure of the law. I mean, right now, there's not everything is criminal or illegal. There's some stuff that's just creepy that doesn't help culture, right? And I don't think it's a matter of criminalizing more or making more illegal. I think it's more of a matter of establishing a culture. And I should say earlier also about Don's point and what resources folks can use. The EEOC, you know, if you just Google EEOC harassment checklist, it has a lot of good resources that any organization can look at about, you know, different things they can be looking at in terms of establishing a policy or dealing with complaints within the organization.
Thank you. Back to Don.
Jade, your website and how people can reach you?
Sure. The firm website is kslaw.com. If you just Google my name, Jade Lambert, you can get to my bio that way, or look me up at kslaw.com. And that's King and Spalding. I'm at in the Chicago office.
Okay. Well, I have a lot of questions, so would Dan, but we're unfortunately getting close to the end. I just want to tell you an interesting thing that happened to me quite recently. Every year I teach at a major college a course for high school students, and I always at the end of it say if any of the students want to do a story for our publications to email me. And last week I got an email from a high school, and I won't say what state, saying that they were not permitting their student to do it because they were afraid of future consequences, which I thought was kind of, because I always tell them they have to, under the new intern law, they have to tell the high school that they're doing this. And in effect, were telling me that I wasn't permitted to do that. And I've really felt chagrined for the last 5 days of getting such a notice. And I really feel bad. And I wonder if there are other people getting the same sort of proactive protection.
Yeah, I mean, I haven't heard about that. But, I mean, it kind of goes to the point Dan was making about the pendulum swinging. I wouldn't want to see it swing so far in the other direction that folks think the safest bet is to not let people pursue opportunities, which it sounds like could be the case you were dealing with.
Well, I was debating bringing it up, Jade, because I've just felt so chagrined about it. Well, Dan, you get time for just one more question.
So where do you think this pendulum going to swing back towards the middle to more balance, or is it going to be stay out for a while?
Well, you know, I think that right now in this moment, there's a big push to just rather than get into ranking what behavior is worse than what other behavior, to just talk about how should people behave in the workplace. So I think that's the conversation that folks are trying to have. I don't think this pendulum has swung so far in the other direction yet. I mean, I think we might have a disagreement on the premise of that question, but I think we'll see things slow down a bit. I think we're going to see people start to explore the nuances more. And certainly when it comes to investigation, you know, there's always, you know, the reporting and some of the investor reactions and the board reactions have happened really fast in this environment. But when it comes to the investigations, there is a process, and you do have to assess credibility and be really thoughtful and deliberate in the approach. And I think that will continue to happen. So I think we're going to start seeing, I hope we can find a middle ground in terms of some of the discussions. So it's, you know, I don't want this movement, which is a possibility for good momentum to affect real change that will benefit women. I don't want it to become something polarizing. And I know there's aspects of it that are already polarizing, but I think there's a lot of common ground already. And I hope that we can continue to push on that.
We've been talking with Jade Lambert. She's an attorney. Jade, your website again and your company and how people can reach you.
Yep, I'm in King and Spalding, Chicago office. It's kslaw.com, or you can just Google Jade Lambert, King and Spalding, and you'll get to my bio.
Thank you so much for joining us today. We've learned a lot, and we thank you.
Well, thank you, Don, and thank you, Dan. It's been great.
You're welcome. Thank you.
Dan Perkins here from recalculating.biz with your featured book. I want to tell you about a recent interview I had with Bob Bethel, a turnaround specialist with lots of success in small business. Bob's new book is Strengthen Your Business, Fail-Proof Strategies for Small Business. He tells us of his life successes and failures that have made him and his clients so successful. Over the years, Bob has brought 77 companies back from the brink and changed them into thriving, profitable businesses. His energy is amazing, and at 74, he proves that you can still have a great deal to give others if you just try. His suggestions are easy to understand and very helpful. One insight struck me was that most companies do not have a plan. The old Chinese proverb says, if you don't know where you're going, then any road will take you there, is true today. Bob Bethel's book, Strengthen Your Business, can be found at Amazon.com or can be ordered at your local bookstore. This has been Dan Perkins with your Recalculating.biz featured book.
Want to know more about health savings accounts for your company or yourself? Go to 2HSA.com and get a free employer's primer. Health savings accounts are a cost-effective way of offering health care benefits to your employees and yourself. HSAs build retirement funds for your employees, improve morale, and reduce your health care benefit cost. For a free employer guide to HSAs, go to 2HSA.com. That's 2HSA.com.
Marcus Lemonis, J.D. Powers, and John Scully, and 100 other presidents and experts contributed to Recalculating the Book. Why did all these people agree to contribute to the book? I'm Don Mazzella, and I'm the editorial director of Small Business Digest. And for 20 years, we have been offering small business leaders information and data to increase profits. Recalculating the Book was named the best small business book by the Independent Press Association. Whether you need help with marketing, staffing, finance, operations, technology, or many other subjects, they're all here in Recalculating the Book. They're now available at Amazon at a reduced cost. We've also created the radio program Recalculating on Recalculating.biz.
Dan, we always like to spotlight new products from creative people. Kathleen Paisano has an innovative beach product, and she's here to tell us about it. Kathleen, welcome to our show.
Thank you, Don. It's great to be here.
Well, I have to tell you, first off, you sent us a sample, and the first thing my wife complimented on was the packaging. You sell the product outside the packaging. But I'm going to start by asking you, what is it that you created, and how does it work? And tell us more.
Okay. Well, No Blow is a beach umbrella anchor. And what it is that it is a nylon bag that you fill up with sand, and then you Velcro the nylon bag to the beach umbrella. There's a long strap from the top of the bag, and it Velcros to the beach umbrella above the spokes. And it keeps your beach umbrella from blowing away while you're sitting on the beach. And then at the end of the day, I'll tell you, at the end of the day, you just dump the sand and the bag folds up really small and you just bring it home again.
Well, I don't think there's any one of us that hasn't had their beach umbrella blown away.
So, I know.
How did you come up with this, and why did you come up with this idea and then decide to market it?
Do you know that I live near the beach, and I would bring my three small children to the beach every day? And I would have up a beach umbrella because it's such a safe form of shade, you know, instead of all the sunblocks. So, I mean, most days it would blow away. So I realized that the sand on the beach could help me, and I used to fill up little bags with sand and attach it to the umbrella. And a woman on the beach came to me, and she said how she had seen a beach umbrella fly and go through a woman's leg one time, like one of those old wooden poles. And since then, she's been so afraid with her children on the beach that an umbrella would, you know, impale them, really. So she told me it would be so great if I would really market this product and sell it. you know, to the public, because people really need a product to purchase. Like, it was definitely something that was needed. So she sort of inspired me along the way.
Well, being inspired is one thing, but there's a lot of steps between thinking of an idea and doing it. But before you answer that, I'm going to turn it over to Dan, because Dan usually does it more methodically.
Okay.
Well, Kathleen, I live on Sanibel Island out in the Gulf of Mexico in southwestern Florida. So I'm surrounded by some of the best beaches in the world. So and pretty strong breezes. So how long have you been marketing? What is your product called?
The product is called No Blow.
N-O-B-L-O.
Yeah.
Okay.
Because you get it. It doesn't blow down the beach. No blow.
Okay. So how long have you been marketing it?
I would say we've had it about 5 or 6 years now.
And do you sell it through bricks and mortar or just on the internet?
Just on the internet.
And what does it retail for?
$20.
And have anybody in the brick and mortar business approached you about selling it at their stores?
A little bit at the beginning. You know, when we were first, of course, we thought that we'd get it in every store in America. But I feel like what happened is, you know, we would try and reach out a lot to different stores, and it just wasn't making an easy connection. And my business partner and I both have a couple of young children. So we realized that it would be so much easier for our business if we just stuck to the internet, you know. So for us, it has worked so well just sticking to the internet.
Yeah, it's really hard to find a national brand in beachside stores because they're also locally run. So finding a major distribution point might have been probably difficult. And they basically are in the business of selling T-shirts more than anything else. So, how has your business grown over the last 5 years?
I feel like it's grown. Like, it's just really has been a slow start to the business. We just do like a little bit of press every year, but it has just continuously bloomed year after year. And I think the main reason for that is that when people have No Blow, they have it out on the beach in such a public space. So it almost has its own advertising on the beach. Like, it's very mm-hmm. visible on the beach. You know, it's something different. And when people have a No Blow on their umbrella, they love to tell people who don't have a No Blow on their umbrella because, you know, it's such a simple solution to a problem.
Is your name on the bag? No Blow?
Yep. The front of the bag has, it's like an anchor, it looks like, with an umbrella above it. And the bottom of the bag just says No Blow. And then on the back of the bag, it has the instructions for how to use it, right printed on the back of the bag. It's like very simple. There's even a line that says fill to here with sand.
And how is it attached to the umbrella?
There's a strap. A long strap, you know, like, and it has, at the end of it, it has like a Velcro, like a boogie board would. You know how like the old boogie boards used to have a Velcro strap on them? It has a very similar Velcro strap, and you put it above the spokes of the umbrella. You just wrap the Velcro strap around up there, and it just holds it for the whole day.
Terrific.
It's so simple.
Yeah. So where are you selling it? Do you know yet for sure, you know, is it on the East Coast, the West Coast, Gulf Coast? Where are people buying it?
I feel like most of our sales come from, especially in the summer in New Jersey, most of the sales come from, like, I would say from Cape Cod all the way down to Virginia Beach. There's like a strong sales from that area, I think, because it probably has grown most out of New Jersey, you know, people seeing it on the beach and just the word slowly spreading. But we do have, you know, quite a few sales that come out of California and a little bit out of Hawaii. And then in the winter months, we just keep growing and growing in Florida. You know, as I guess more and more people see No Blow on the beach, it just has been so winter, the Florida area maintains us for the whole winter, which is, you know, slowly more and more sales each year.
Well, after the show's over, we'd like to chat with you about some ideas we might help be able to help you with expanding your market. But that's for another time.
Great.
Okay. Yeah, we'd love to help you. So what have you learned about – is this your first business?
It's definitely my first business.
What have you learned in the 5 years that you've been in the business about starting it up?
I have to say that, and I'm going to be honest with you, the most important thing I've learned is how easy it is to get in debt with a business and how hard it is not to get in debt with the business. And, like, I feel like my business partner and I, since we are just really stay-at-home moms, it's been really our main objective is not to let the business become a financial burden on our family. And we never have let it. Like, we've always just not infused money into it, you know, on a credit scale, you know, just sort of because it would have been such a burden to us then.
Mm-hmm.
And I feel like that is not always so easy in our society today because there are so many different marketing methods, you know, and different things that people, you know, present to us. But we have tried to keep it, you know, so that we just make a small little, you know, we try and keep it so we don't have any debt with Noblo.
So you're profitable, but not perhaps as profitable as you'd like to be?
Yeah, we're profitable always, but we're not. I would say that Noblo, I think there's 175 million beach umbrellas in America, you know. And I would say that maybe over the past couple of years, if we sold like 60,000 Noblo, I'm just guessing.
Mm-hmm.
So we have, you know, I feel like the company has such a potential of, you know, customers, you know, and we just slowly have been getting out there.
Okay. So are you thinking about any other products or is it simply just this?
I feel like we had come up with other simple products, you know, because once we started Noblo, sort of had a connection into the manufacturing. You know, you sort of are already on a path, has already been built to make other products.
Mm-hmm.
And we made a product. It was a boogie board backpack. And we had 100 made because that was what we could afford out of our budget. And it was so great. And we sold all 100 of them. And it was a really great product because we are such beach moms that we kind of figure out what is needed with a product and what's not needed. And it was a great product and we sold all 100 of them, but we couldn't get more made unless we had like a $5,000 unit order. And we haven't moved forward with that. We're not ready to, you know, put out such a large quantity of money.
So you're really trying to stay within your budget and at the same time trying to find ways to grow your business profitably without having to incur any significant amount of debt.
Exactly.
That's a great philosophy.
Yeah, it's funny. It's like it has worked so well for us. And, you know, like I had been in a women's business group for a while, you know, on the computer. And it was a great women's business program I was in. And, like, a lot of the women had been on Shark Tank. Like, a lot of these women have products we've all heard of. And some of them were in, like, $250,000 debt. And I just could never have a burden like that on my life. Like, it was such a burden for them, you know. And, like, that would take a lot of Noblo to sell to catch up to that $250,000 is how I look
sure.
at it.
But if you sold 60,000 Noblos at $20 a piece, that's a pretty significant business.
Yeah, I feel like, and like we, I mean, I have to tell you that it's just been like a slow grow and it has been just great.
And you've stayed within yourself.
And we stayed, and like, that's why I feel like I love Noblo because I feel like I am free from it. You know, it's not a burden on me. And like, I get so excited when I talk about the business because it is just such a free thing, you know. It has worked out so well. And you would love a Noblo. I'm going to send you one for Sanibel Island.
Okay. I'd appreciate that. Well, after we talk, I'll give you an address and you can send it to me. My son and daughter-in-law and granddaughter went to the beach this morning, and and they said it was windy, Grandpa. So I understand the whole issue of umbrella blowing away. Have you ever thought about selling the business?
I feel like we would sell the business, definitely. You know, I feel
but not,
like it's
not yet.
I feel like we love the business, you know, and I'm sure if if somebody offered us money for the business, I would say that we would probably be interested. You know, I feel like at this time we love dealing with no blow because it's not a burden on us, but of course we would, you know, take an offer to sell the business.
Do you have a patent for your product?
We have a trademark because we had my business partner's family is very involved in patent law. So we were, you know, like her extended family. So we were going to get a patent, and we had started to work on getting a patent. And it was going great. And then it was a lot of women in this business group I was in were starting to have patent issues. And I realized that people were spending $100,000 to fight for their patent, and you know, it wasn't really, I didn't think we would, if we had to protect our patent, I don't think we would ever have enough money to protect it, you know. So we just got a trademark, and we do not have a patent.
But are there competitors out there that have taken your idea and run with it?
No, not at all. And I mean, I have to tell you, you saw the product. It's such a simple product. And like, nobody, like, there's a couple of similar products, you know, that are a little bit more complex now that people are filling up with sand. But I feel like, you know, since there are 175 million beach umbrellas, if we just had a little piece of the share, it would be perfect with me.
Talking about 175 million beach umbrellas, and you only need a small piece to have a very successful business.
I know, and that's how I feel. So I feel like, and that's how I look at the entire, you know, so we did go after the patent, and it just wasn't for us. So we do have a trademark on the name, and, like, that's the best that we can do. And No Blow's made in America. It's made in New Jersey, and we have it packaged in New Jersey. There's a place locally that, you know, people with special needs package No Blow. And, like, it's just a gentle little company we have.
But let me go a different way. We often deal with a lot of women who are moms like yourself and who develop a product. What motivated you to go out? Yes, you saw the product, but there's a lot more to just thinking about it to doing it. What impelled you to go and really start a business like this?
Isn't it so funny? I think, do you know that before I had the children, I feel like I've always been like a self-motivated person, you know, always doing different things. And then I was staying home with the children, and I feel like starting No Blow kind of gave me something in my life that I could like think about and like grow while I was raising the family, you know, really from home on my own computer. And like, I feel like that's why it ended up working so well, because it was kind of like a little side thing for me as a stay-at-home mom. And I feel like it was such a healthy thing for me to have while my children were so little.
And your partner is also a stay-at-home mom?
She's a stay-at-home mom as well.
How do you divide up your responsibilities for the company?
I know. I feel like that I am really the person who's on like the forefront of the entire company. Like, I have been in charge of getting the manufacturing done. I've been in charge of the packaging. I've really kind of run the entire, facade of the company. And my business partner, Beth, has like the best ideas. Like, she came up with the logo and the name. And like whenever I'm not sure which direction to go in, I can just ask Beth and she will think about it for a little while and she'll know which direction to go in. But she, like, she's kind of in the background as a great resource. And sometimes she will have, you know, she'll come across a great idea for No Blow and she'll send me information about it. But I will do all the presentation for it, you know, and I'll get it all together. And that's really how we run our business. Like, I make most of the decisions without, you know, and she is fine with that. And we have a 50-50 split with the business.
Hmm. Hmm. If you had to do it over, are there any things you would have changed?
Wow. That's such an interesting question. I don't think there's anything that I would have changed if I had to do it over. I can't think of anything, you know. We've had such a fun time. Like at the beginning, we used to go, you know, to all the stores along the New Jersey coast and try and get them sold in stores. But what started happening is all the people who work in the stores don't own the stores. You know, they're not the decision maker in the store. A lot of the stores we went to. So it was always such a blockade, you know, to find the person who owns the store that it wasn't worth our time. And we do a lot of, like, the little town beach shows, you know, where they have, like, a craft fair, and we'll set up a table with No Blow. But I can't think of many things that I would do differently.
Hmm. I'm going to ask one more question, then turn it back
okay.
to Dan, which, to me, your product would make such a great giveaway at a convention. People, I think, would glom. Can you make a customized...
I know we can. Like, I feel like we can screen print anything on the product. And there was maybe about 4 years ago I started to try and, you know, go down that road. But then things happened with my family. And, like, we could screen print. We started trying to get all the different hotels, you know, they could screen print, like, Marriott on the bag. Or, you know, all the, like, New York City Marathon has so many giveaways, and they could give away a No Blow. Like, it's such a practical product to give away for people that would actually be used. And we can screen print anything on the bag.
Back to you, Dan.
Thank you. Kathleen, you said on several times during this interview that you didn't want to be a burden to your family. I'm assuming you mean the burden of finances on your family.
Exactly.
But given what you know today, after 5 years of being in the business, would you go back and make that same decision, or would you say, wait a minute, maybe if I'd have borrowed a few $1,000, I could have gotten where I needed to go quicker?
No, I think I would have definitely done exactly the same thing we did. You know, like, I feel like I, just all the years, like, I've come to realize that I love, you know, No Blow and our little business so much, and I feel like that's because I don't owe my brother $65,000 for it, or I don't owe the bank $65,000 for it, you know? And perhaps if we had gone that way, there would be a bigger financial gain. But I'm not so sure, you know.
Okay. And is there a point where have you ever been to the point where you had trouble meeting supply demands?
No, I feel like do you know that I feel like sometimes as the summer comes on, like as this summer's coming on, like our sales are growing more and more than they were last year. But mm-hmm. I will just put in an order a couple of weeks ahead, you know, because it only takes a few weeks to have my product made since it's made in America. So, like, I can just foresee that this summer sales, you know, and I just have ordered a little bit more recently, and I'll get them in 2 to 3 weeks and be able to, you know, just hold them. And then if I see it's still growing, it only takes maybe 3 weeks for me to get another couple of thousand No Blow.
Okay. All right, sir. Don, back to you.
Oh, thank you so much. Kathleen, your website, I'm very interested in the product, but your website and how people can reach you?
Oh, sure. Our website is thenoblow.com.
Can you spell it out?
People, okay, www.thenoblow.com.
It's really interesting. A link to her, to Kathleen's website, will be on recalculating.biz tonight, where you can hear this and every other program. Kathleen, thank you so much for joining us. It's been a real pleasure.
Thank you so much. It was so nice to be on your show.
Kathleen, just stay on the line as we hang up.
Okay.
Tell me, Dan, tell me about your latest book.
My current book that's coming out, I should say, is Why Can't Grammy Remember Me? And it's really the first book written for children between the ages of 9 and 12 and their families dealing with dementia. Dementia is a growing problem with the elderly in the United States and around the world. And we are not very well informed about what's going on, what's happening. So I wrote this book in the form of a mystery. And I have two little girls, 9 and 12, who have a magical power to seem to be able to find things that are lost. And so they go to their dads and moms and they say, you know, we work all over the neighborhood helping people find things, and we seem to find things. And their dad says, yes, you have a magical talent to do that. And they said, we'd like to start a business to see if we can help other people. So they decided to start a business. The two girls' name are Hudson and Charlotte. And they start H&C's Lost and Found. If you've lost it, we find it. And so they build a business, and they convince the dads to build them an office and a treehouse in the backyard. And they get busy making posters and flyers trying to get customers. And their dads take them downtown, and they put them in the windows and on the telephone poles and light poles. And they go home, and first week goes by, and nobody comes. And the second week and third week, and nobody comes. They're really, really dejected. And the fourth week comes, and there's a knock at the door. And they walk over and open the door, and there's a young man standing there with one of their flyers in his hands. And he says to them, my dad says the reason why my Grammy can't remember me is because she's lost her memory. And your flyer says you find things that are lost. Can you find my Grammy's memory? Well, they don't know anything about memory. So they take his name and they go see their dads to see what can happen. And the story evolves into how they learn about what dementia is and what's going on in the body when somebody has dementia. And then they decide, while they can't find their customer's memory, they can help him build the tools to retain her in his memory. And so at the end of the book, there are about 10 to 12, 13 things that families can do together to work on to preserve the memory of grandma and grandpa so the generations can know who these people were. And that's the story.
What a great book. When will it be available, and how can people get it?
Well, it'll be available on Amazon.com. A lot of people who have read it, who've had moms and dads that have been stricken with Alzheimer's and dementia, tell me that they really now begin to understand what's happening in grandma's brain. And we took a different approach. Rather than do the typical brain cross-section, I work with the artist, and we design highways in the brain. And there's a brain of one of the little girls and the brain of Grammy. They both have highways, roads, but where the girl's brain, everything is green and go. Grammy's brain is full of no left turns, do not enter, stop, no right turns. So all of the messages that need to come from our brain get screwed up and we can't function. Great illustrations, though. Wonderful illustrations.
Well, say goodbye, Dan.
All right.
Time for us to go.
Thank you for joining us. And by the way, if you didn't hear all of today's show, you can go to recalculating.biz and you can pick up this show and past shows to expand your knowledge as becoming more successful entrepreneurs. Thank you for joining us, and we'll talk to you next week.
Thank you for joining us on Recalculating. We hope the information you received on today's episode was helpful to you in starting and growing your business. Please go to our website, recalculating.biz, to contact us, to listen to past shows, and see special offers. Until next time, remember, if you grow, we grow. Join us next week for more helpful ideas to make your business a great success. Recalculating, a program designed to help you be successful.